From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. On today's show, a message from the State Department to Milwaukee area college students. We need you.
Later, a Milwaukee man produces a film and a board game about an invasive water species.
Plus, why it makes sense for the Milwaukee rep and a Cincinnati company to join forces on a new production.
It allows the arts to live for longer. If you're an actor in one of these plays and you might get hired in to do a show for 8 weeks, you add a second theater, and all of a sudden your 8 weeks becomes maybe 14 or 16 weeks.
And an in-studio performance by the Midwestern Irish band Bua playing tonight in Milwaukee.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Over the next 18 months or so, the state of U.S. diplomacy will likely be under a microscope thanks to the presidential campaign of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But for all the headlines her role in foreign policy generated, there are hundreds of lesser-told stories of diplomacy at work.
A former U.S. ambassador to the Philippines will shed some light on them in Milwaukee tomorrow. Harry K. Thomas has been in the U.S. Foreign Service for more than 30 years, serving also as U.S. ambassador to Bangladesh and as Director General of the Foreign Service.
Thomas speaks tomorrow at the World Citizen Celebration, sponsored by the International Institute of Wisconsin, following Thursday talks on two Milwaukee college campuses. But he's with us in the studio as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here. I've always wanted to be on NPR.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Let me start with a kind of a big question about Foreign Service work.
Sure.
You have been a longtime member of the Foreign Service at a variety of levels, including as U.S. ambassador to the Philippines. Can you speak to, first of all, what attracted you to the work in the first place? And secondly, how has the nature of diplomacy as a foreign policy strategy changed in the time since you first entered the work?
Well, Mitch, I'm a very different story than most of my colleagues. I just needed a job. I was working as an urban planner. I worked for a man who had been a Foreign Service officer and was a Yale graduate, and he told me to go to law school or in the Foreign Service. I didn't want to go to law school, so I asked him, what's the Foreign Service? Went to libraries, thought the Foreign Service was full of stuck-up people, and applied for USAID, and they turned me down. So I had to take the Foreign Service exam. But most of my colleagues, this is something they learned about in high school or college or graduate school, and it's been a year, you know, a many-year dream. But that's why I'm high on the Foreign Service, because it can take someone like me, who's never left the United States, didn't speak a foreign language, and allow you to pursue these dreams.
Well, and so what kept you in it for all those years? If this wasn't something that you initially envisioned yourself doing, what was it that once you got into it made you realize that, that this really could be your life's work?
The intellectual fervor of the people. My colleagues are brilliant. The people that I met around the world that taught me humility because they were all smarter than I am. The challenges that we face as a nation that keep changing. The opportunities to see people and try to help influence policy and protect the United States.
Well, and so has diplomacy changed in those years since you first began? Do you see the climate for what the Foreign Service does and what the State Department does as having changed since you first took that Foreign Service exam?
No. The tools have. We have social media, the internet, all of these tools that help make us more efficient. But the nature of the work has not changed. So much is dealt on personal relationships that you have to build, that take time to gain trust and understanding.
National defense and defense policy gets a lot of the attention when it comes to foreign policy. Is that, frankly, okay? Does diplomacy play out better quietly?
Yes, it does. In most instances, no one wants to be beaten upon the head. No one wants to be publicly told what they have to do. So we try quiet diplomacy because most often that is effective. However, there are times when a nation is violating international principles and will not change, that public diplomacy is called for. And we use that in various ways, in criticism, or even if Congress or the president authorizes sanctions.
So when public diplomacy starts playing out, it sounds like it is typically because something has gone wrong before that.
No, because public diplomacy is varied. We may use social media to attract Fulbright scholars or Humphrey and Watson scholars. We all have websites. Every ambassador has to have an Instagram account, a Twitter account these days to get our message out. And that might be what you would call soft power. But defense and diplomacy go hand in hand, and they always have, and they always will. People may highlight some things these days, but the military wants us to do our job, and not they don't want to have to be called in.
What did you take most from your 3 years as ambassador to the Philippines?
It was the first time I had worked in a country that had been a U.S. colony, and I learned that there were positive things the United States did in bringing English and democracy and helping with freedom of religion that did not exist there. And I also learned why we should never colonize a people, that there are too many negative things, including the confidence and the psyche that go with it.
Well, and I wonder if many of the troubles around the world are still the legacy of colonization.
Well, that depends on your argument. Obviously, you have to look at all of history for totality, but you should not use something that may have happened 50 or 100 years ago as an excuse for lack of democracy or lack of human rights or lack of ability to educate or why you may be corrupt.
One of the issues that you spent a lot of time on, if I'm correct, in the Philippines was the status of women and girls there.
Sure.
And that seems to be an issue in a number of countries, especially in the developing world. Can you talk to why it was so important as your time was playing out in the Philippines?
Well, Mitch, I think it's important everywhere, including Milwaukee. Educated women, educated girls are better for society. I don't have to review the results. I'm sure you and your listeners know that. But in the Philippines, it was a shame to me that talented people had to leave the country to succeed, that there was human trafficking, that there was incest, the domestic violence, all things that we have in our country. But my charge was to help the Philippines reduce and eliminate all of this. And that's why. But also as an American, you see the opportunities that my daughter and your wife have had, and you want other people to have those opportunities, no matter their gender.
As we think about global issues, we tend to think of the rise of militant Islam as an issue that is really based in the Middle East. But the Muslim population is extremely large in Asia. What do you see as maybe the challenges, but also the opportunities as we pursue our foreign policy in that regard in Asia?
Well, first of all, we should never generalize. Well, most people look at themselves by their country more than their religion. I recall when I served in Bangladesh, which is a democracy, we use the term moderate Muslim democracy. They told me never use that term. How would you like the United States to be termed as a moderate Christian democracy? So I learned from that. I also learned that there are many in Islam who look upon attack on one Muslim as an attack on all. And some Christians do that also. That's how our response to ISIS began in many ways. So first of all, don't generalize. Be specific. Learn the culture. Learn the nation. A Muslim in Indonesia is often very different than one in Palestine or Milwaukee. And they have their own class differences, their gender differences, their race differences. So we have to understand that just as Christians do. But we need to engage with the Muslim community around the world in ways that are specific to their cultures, local cultures.
If I understand your current role correctly, you do work in the Southwest in trying to recruit people for State Department work.
Yes.
And I don't know people realize that the State Department actively recruits.
And I'll tell your listeners to go on careers.state.gov because the next Foreign Service exam is in June. followed by that in October. And we're always looking for people to join the civil service and the foreign service. The reason I and 15 other colleagues are in universities around the nation is because we want to define diversity not just by race or gender, but also by geography. When I joined, if you were from Mississippi or Arizona, you went to Yale. If you were from Alabama or Alaska, you went to Harvard. But we think there are fine institutions all over, like Cardinal Stritch, where I was this morning, or Marquette, where I'll be going this afternoon. And we're looking for Americans from all of these places, so I encourage them. But also, you know, I think there's another program I'd just like to talk about for a few seconds. We have a high school exchange program for 15 to 17 and 15 to 18-year-olds who can go to a Japan, Korea, China, India, spend 4 to 5 weeks, 2 summers, learning a critical language, full immersion, at total U.S. government expense.
And so what makes the right person for both of these
For the high
realms?
School, it's somebody that wants to learn a foreign language. We think there'll be more better chance to get into a college of their choice if they can learn a critical language. And we, as a major country, are one of the few countries where most people only speak one language. And you can go to a poor village in India or Africa and people are speaking 4 or 5 languages. So we want to change that. For a person looking for this as a profession, we want people like you, Mitch, people who are a little bit inquisitive, a little bit skeptical, but believers in democracy and human rights, market economics in a balanced way. And why not come to Wisconsin? Why not come to the great universities here as well in Arizona? And I tell you, every time I go to Utah, BYU, boy, that is a fervent recruiting ground. And you meet some wonderful people, much more diverse than the average American would think.
Are there challenges in your work? I mean, do you get a lot of misconceptions when you speak with people?
Sure. A lot of people think the State Department is the local State Department. They've never heard of the Foreign Service. We need to do a better job in America of selling what we do because our job is to keep the peace, sell American products, bring tourists here and help the economy and protect America. So we need to do a better job ourselves. I'll put that on the Foreign Service and not on the American people.
As you think back on your time in the Foreign Service, the various places you served, the various roles that you have had, do you look back and think, you know, are there tangible benefits from the work that you have done?
Yes. We often get these questions, and sometimes people are looking for a big building or a great peace agreement that you've signed. But I'll just give you a small story. In 2010, we tried to bring my favorite sport, baseball, to the Philippines, where only the wealthy and some kids on sugar plantations played. We brought Ken Griffey Jr. there. They didn't know who he was. We taught kids on a garbage dump who climb up that place called Smoky Mountain, get garbage, sell it, and eat it every day, teaching them to play baseball in a field of dreams. We got the mayor to build. And we worked with the university to get them some remedial education. Last summer, 2014, the boys didn't do too well. And they lost out. But the girls, they won the Asian championship and got to come to Delaware from a garbage dump. Those are some of the small things that we can do, that we do with our tax money that I think all Americans can support, giving them a view, a glimpse of the opportunities that we have here that we often take for granted. So we have a lot of small takeaways as large ones. You know, I worked at the White House on 9/11, and I'm from New York City. I'll never forget that, how we all came together as a country after that, being there. I got to meet Nelson Mandela 3 times when he got out of jail. Had tea with the Dalai Lama. Those are all kinds of things that sound big, but you know, you learn often that the shoeshine boy is just as important. You can learn just as much, if not more, from that person, the wisdom of some of these people. So, again, I've learned humility, the limits of American power, the greatness of America, and the ability we give everybody else. And so there have been many things, but just think of baseball in Delaware.
And to think you didn't really want to take the Foreign Service exam.
No, I didn't. And that's why I set myself up as an example of I've been truly blessed the opportunities our nation has given me.
Well, Harry Thomas, thank you so much for spending time with us and sharing these stories as well.
Thank you, Mitch.
Harry K. Thomas is former U.S. ambassador to the Philippines and former ambassador to Bangladesh. Currently, he serves as diplomat in residence at Arizona State University. He's in Milwaukee as the keynote speaker at the World Citizen Celebration that's sponsored by the International Institute of Wisconsin.
Our series of Earth Week interviews wraps up after the break with a maker of a short film and a board game about the invasive species known as quagga mussels. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this week, you might have tuned into a conversation our environmental reporter Susan Bentz shared with John Goerda. He described his new documentary, Milwaukee, A City Built on Water, which premiered on Earth Day on public television.
You'll have a chance to see his one-hour piece again tomorrow at the Avalon Theater in Bayview. Goerda's is one of several locally produced films and shorts that's featured in an event called Our Water.
Michael Tim pulled the event together. He comes at the topic of water from a unique perspective, having worked for over a decade as a writer and journalist.
In 2013, Tim completed a master's degree at UWM's School of Freshwater Sciences. During that time, he began work on his own short film about quagga mussels. It's an invasive species that has had dramatic impacts on Lake Michigan. He also made a companion board game of sorts that he calls Mussel Madness.
The film is part of Saturday's lineup, and WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bent sat down with Tim in a bustling cafe to learn how the whole event came together.
It dramatizes the story of the mussel invasion of the Great Lakes. This is something that I had become aware of. I was really fascinated by the fact that this huge ecological disturbance had happened, and yet people really didn't know about it. I really felt it in a way that would communicate the enormity of that impact. And so when I was at the School of Freshwater Sciences, 2013, the opportunity came up to work with people to actually create this film. And so we went out in a boat, I worked with divers who did underwater footage, and I wrote the narrative, I got the people involved to put this together into this story that is meant to reach you on a slightly more emotional level rather than just here are the facts, here are the figures, which is what science is good at, and bring it to general audiences. So I had that product, and I called up Lee Barzak, who's the owner of the Avalon Theater, back before the theater was open. I said, hey, I'm making this film. Can I show it at your theater? And he's like, yeah, that'd be great. Let's do it. And plus, I want you to run it as like a preview before our regular shows, because I'm interested in doing like newsreel kind of things at the Avalon. We're working out those details. But he's very committed to that kind of thing. But I had this nugget. I had this film. And I also had Rebecca Clapper's film, which I had asked her, would you like to be a part of this if I show it? Because who wants to just come to the theater for an 8-minute show? Hers is a 50-minute documentary, and it's on the Great Lakes. It's on issues of diversions and how the Great Lakes Compact works, where your water goes, where it comes from, the physical system, and how it relates with people. It's online. It hadn't really been, like, shared with people. So I thought, well, this is a great way to share that. So we had that product going on. Get a call from John Goerda as he's working on his film. Hey, can you hook me up with people with some underwater footage for my film, which we're also going to be showing, Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. And I said, sure, here you go, here's some connections. He used some of the footage from my film in their film, and I was talking to Claudia Luz, the director-producer of that film, and I'm like, hey, we're doing this thing at the Avalon. Would you like to be a part of that? And I'm like, yeah, sure, let's do it. So, you know, a little bit of juggling months down the line later when we nailed down the ducks in a row, we've got this kind of package of films. Plus, I had been in conversations with Jenny Plevin, Milwaukee Water Commons, and she also works at DocUWM making short documentaries. And we're interested in sort of peppering the event with those. Turns out that evolved into sort of one additional short. So we'll have my short, we'll have her short that showcases the story of the Milwaukee Water Commons, which is a kind of a grassroots effort to get diverse constituencies together around water, using it to solve different problems. And they're a fascinating group. So we've got the history, the community, the science, and then for me, the storytelling, or showing why we should care.
So, Michael, you're a writer, you're an editor, you're a filmmaker. When you decided to go to the School of Freshwater Sciences, what was your intent? You graduated with a degree in?
It was in the professional track. They have a thesis track and a professional track. The professional track is really designed to hybridize science with business, science with communication, so that you've got people who are aware of water science, but able to straddle multiple worlds. I went in feeling was, okay, I'm going to go in and with a plan of being a better environmental journalist. You know, that would be my end point. And I came out feeling much more passionate about science communication in a more generalized sense, as evidenced by this game that I've created, but also just feeling the need. You know, there's so much knowledge out there that people generate, but there aren't as many viable bridges to get it out to people who make decisions. And I feel I fit in that space.
Now, did Muscle Madness, did that come out of your time with the School of Freshwater Sciences?
It was really on my own time, but it was definitely inspired by the work we were doing at the school. And one of the central conceits to a lot of the educational program at School of Freshwater Sciences is the mussel invasion. One of our tasks as a group assignment at one point was to model how nutrient dynamics change as a result of the mussel invasion. And it sounds simple in a way, but then it becomes very complicated very quickly. So one of the challenges and one of the emphases that they had when I was there was modeling. And can you make something that's grossly simplified but that helps tell the story? Taking that modeling approach, you realize it actually is just a game. You know, a game is a set of rules. You have a clear endpoint. You tweak something, it changes, and results happen. Central to the game, it's a cooperative game where you're basically playing against a common antagonist. In this case, it's the mussels. And so you play as one of the Great Lakes, and you go around the seasons, and then your lake has what I call phytos, which are these little fuzzballs, and they get eaten by mussels, which are, as you may see, little hair clips with eyeballs. And the kids love them. Adults even love them. I don't know anyone who doesn't smile when they see them. And so this is a way.
So you've made each and every one of these?
Oh, yes. When we go to the next scale, we'll have like an eyeball gluing party, you know? But the idea is, it comes out of economics literature, actually, but you see it in practice, making tangible what you can't see. So here you have the lake system where you don't see phytoplankton. How can you value something that you aren't aware exists? So the game...
And let's tell people what phytoplankton is in case they don't know.
Sure. Phytoplankton are the little floating creatures in the water that take sunlight and transform it into energy, and they're the base of the aquatic food web. So they're really important. And mussels, which are little tiny clams that suck the water into them, and they came through ballast water of our ships. They proliferated in the Great Lakes because they didn't have a competitor or a predator that checked their growth, and they did very well in our system, but they have changed then the dynamic because they've sucked a lot of that phytoplankton away. They've sucked the nutrients away so there's less food for fish. When you clear the water, the light penetrates deeper, so then you have increased algae growing, which then washes up on shore. People don't like that. And so this game is a way to make tangible that invisible dynamic in a way that's abstracted the way a scientific model is, but that is fun to play the way a game is. And what I find is that because the game is set up, if anyone in the lakes loses, no one can win, then the kids discover that they have a reason to help other lakes. And again, if you look at economics literature, this is something that people have really, in the real world, that we find very challenging. You know, like, how do you cooperate across political economic divides? Why do you see that there's an incentive to help others? And so I think that one of the value propositions of this game is that it's embedded in the structure, this cooperative dynamic. And I see that emergent in the gameplay that happens. The kids love to spend their fish bucks to help other lakes get rid of mussels, even more than they love amassing the fish bucks, because they see that the economy and the environment are interrelated. And so I'm happy when they get those kinds of connections.
So when you consider just the few things we've talked about today, the Muscle Madness, going to School of Freshwater Sciences, putting this event together, what's the heart of your motivation in all this, Michael?
Connecting science with general audiences. My passion is to create something that does that function. I feel I've done that with the game. I feel that's where the film exists. And the kinds of exercises I've done through studies at School of Freshwater Sciences were always with that in mind. Studying for the master's kind of honed my ability to articulate that to some extent. If you'd asked me 3 years ago, I may not have told you that was my mission, but now I can tell you that's my mission. And I feel confident about that, and I feel like, yes, that's true. And so there's a lot of self-examination that happened over the course of going back to school that led me to that point. And you're on a journey still. You know, you don't know where you may lead.
Michael Timm's short film on quagga mussels called Life in Our Lake will kick off a triple feature at the Avalon Theater tomorrow, beginning at 10 a.m. You'll find a link to the full event details at WUWM.com.
The Milwaukee Rep teams up with the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park to produce the prequel to Peter Pan. We'll learn all about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tonight, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater opens the Tony Award-winning play Peter and the Starcatcher. This prequel to the beloved children's classic Peter Pan fills in some gaps, like why didn't Peter want to grow up, and where did the Lost Boys come from?
But what makes this production so interesting is that it's actually co-produced by the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, who originated this particular production. Blake Robison is the artistic director of the Cincinnati Playhouse and the director of this production, and Mark Clements is the artistic director of the Milwaukee Rep. They join me in the studio now. Great to have you both here this morning.
Thanks.
With your Americano. Or at least it would be, Mark, if you actually had a coffee.
If I actually had one. Yeah.
Right.
But I will be having one soon.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, I feel better. You could have brought it in.
I know. I didn't get it together in time.
Oh, all right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this wonderful collaboration between Milwaukee Rep and Cincinnati Playhouse. How did this happen and why this particular play?
I can't remember exactly. I think it might have been at the Chicago TCG, which is my first one that I met Blake. And he was running a theater in D.C. at the time. And, you know, we were talking about the possibility of working together. We seemed to vibe well. And I actually took a trip to D.C. to Blake's theater at the time, the Roundhouse, to see a play that he'd directed and commissioned. And we just sort of, you know, I think got on well and then started talking in earnest about how things might come together and how we might work together. And then Blake was appointed about 3 years ago to Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, which is a theater that is a wonderful theater, has a lot of values and aesthetics and architecture that is not dissimilar to our own. Also, the staff, the things that our staff hold very, very dear in terms of standard of costume build, props, scenic presentation. I think those values, their staff have, and they can build to that level. And I think the things that I care about in terms of an audience development and taking an audience on a journey with you, I think are quite akin to Blake's take on things. And we found more and more commonality between the two of us. And so it seemed like we were really perfect bed partners, you know, to explore. And this is our first, and so far, so great. And hopefully this will be.
Is it opening here first and then going to Cincinnati?
No, other way around.
Other way
around. We are bringing it from Cincinnati.
Okay.
So I went and saw the play a couple of weeks ago, and I really was so happy seeing it because there's nothing worse than seeing a show where you think, oh man, we've got a lot of work to do. But just, you know, it looked beautiful, and Blake's done a wonderful job and did everything he said he was going to do with the play, which were my key issues and the thrust of the conversation that we had. So we're very excited to have him and them here, and we hope it's the first of many fruitful collaborations.
Well, I thank you for that, and I certainly feel the same way. You know, these collaborative productions, or what we call co-productions, are becoming more and more common in the American theater. I think it started for financial reasons. You know, if you can share some of the costs, that's helpful to both organizations. It might allow you to do a bigger production than you would normally be able to do on your own. But I think even more important than that, it allows the art to live for longer. If you're an actor in one of these plays and you might get hired in to do a show for 8 weeks, you add a second theater and all of a sudden your 8 weeks becomes maybe 14 or 16 weeks. And now you can really start to make a living at it. Also, the play itself benefits. You know, the longer you run it, the actors find new rhythms and they settle into their performances. So there is a value-added aspect to it. And I would just reiterate what Mark said. The most important thing is that you share values with your co-producing partner. And Mark and I have a mutual appreciation of each other's theaters. And I think we share an idea of what good theater and good storytelling is.
What is good storytelling?
Well, in this case, good storytelling is Peter and the Starcatcher. Peter and the Starcatcher is based on a series of young adult novels written by the novelist Ridley Pearson and the humorist Dave Barry. And they were condensed into a single evening of theater by Rick Ellis, who is a wonderful theater guy who wrote the book for the big hit Jersey Boys. So there's a lot of literary and theatrical royalty coming together to do this. It is good storytelling because it marries the narrative of Peter Pan in his early days. It's a prequel to the Peter Pan story. So you learn a lot about how Peter became Pan and where the Lost Boys come from and where Neverland comes from, who is Captain Hook anyway, all those sorts of things. But it does it in an especially theatrical way. And I think when we're looking at these co-productions, we're looking for stories that can be told effectively in a uniquely theatrical way. We're not trying to do it with special effects, with CGI and green screens. We're trying to embrace what the theater does best, which is to spark our audience's imagination.
And what's interesting about it, and I like about it, I'm really interested. If I think back to some of the most entertaining and meaningful theatrical experiences I've had, they've often been things where whether you're six in the audience or you're 66, you're having a shared experience of a play. So you just can view it on different levels. I mean, and I liken it in a way, if you think of Winnie the Pooh. I mean, I still love reading Winnie the Pooh. And you just, as you get older, you go, oh, that was so clever. That was so interesting. But, you know, if you're four, you're just enjoying the pictures and what Piglet's doing with Pooh. But as you get older, you appreciate that friendship and the values in life. And I think there's an element of this. And I think it's a play that, you know, that fascinating period where children transition from being children to adults to something when they start moving away from parents and have different needs of their parents, which might be distance. Those transitions are complex. And I think the play taps into those in a really interesting way without kind of hammering it on the head.
Right. I think of this production as cross-generational, which is to say it's not a piece of children's theater. Mm-hmm. It's not for the youngest kids.
No.
But, you know, it's not exactly Shakespeare or Eugene O'Neill on the other end. It lives comfortably in between. You likened it to Winnie the Pooh. And I like to say it's similar to a good Pixar film.
Yeah.
In that there's adult humor and references that goes over the heads of the little one. And there's a sophistication to that humor. But then there's a lot of physical comedy. There's a lot of visual storytelling that younger kids relate to. It is that piece of theater that grandparent, parent, and kid and grandkid can all come to together and enjoy on their own level.
It behooves us to, as theater makers and the people that make things happen or not in our theaters, to try and explore that strand of work. I think it's a really valuable strand that's in addition to perhaps younger people just coming to a Christmas Carol once a year or something, or maybe going to a children's theater with a school or with a group or something. So I think there's a real place for it, and I think we need to mine it as best we can and develop works like that.
We have found that at our theater as we try to do more of these cross-generational works. It's something that Christmas Carol audiences can add on to their season and start to create a family track through the rep's season or through the Playhouse's season.
Yeah.
That's extraordinarily valuable to us to get people not just to come back more often, but to know that the theater's going to have something for all parts of their life. And in a very real way, we are building an audience for the future. You get a kid hooked at 8, 10 years old who comes in and has that extraordinary experience of seeing theatrical storytelling for the first time. I can remember what mine was, and I'm sure Mark can as well.
What was it?
I saw the original production of Chorus Line
when
I was a teenager, and that just completely blew my mind. And then I went back a few years later, and I got to see David Bowie in The Elephant Man. How's that for a dichotomy? But I was already hooked. Peter and the Starcatcher will hook kids. This is the production that will capture them, capture their imaginations, and make them lifelong theater goers. Mm.
Okay, Mark, what was yours?
Well, you know, my parents were in the business, so my parents were both actors, so it was kind of not new to me. But one of the things I do remember is being taken to the Palace Theatre Westcliff in Essex, in England, where I grew up, to see the most terrible production of Midsummer Night's Dream. And I think if that had been my first experience of the theater, I might not have ever come again. So I think not only getting kids to come to the theater, taking them to the right thing, I think is so important. And that's why plays like this give us a fighting chance to capture people rather than scare people for the next 20 years.
Or scar them for their lives.
Yeah. So, you know, I was very fortunate, you know, as I say, I grew up with parents who were in the arts and were actors and then became theater managers. But that's always on my mind, you know, when we invite, when we do our immersion days for education and things, that I really want to make sure that if it's a play that's a little complex, that the work that we do before the performance gives them an insight into the making. There's a sense of ownership that they have of the play. We're telling them to look out for things, not trying to spoil the experience, but just try to contextualize things. You know, you even if it's to say, listen, if you might have to kind of really concentrate in the first half hour before you start connecting. It's not instant. So, you know, try and invest in that time, and then I think you're going to get something out of it. Just having that opportunity to say that to people's honest, if it's something very wordy like Death of a Salesman, the payoff we found by doing that is phenomenal, because once they get into it and they've met the actors and they've connected. So I think it's all right, not just the what it is, it's just how you frame it. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you do it well enough. But yeah, I think all of those things are pretty important.
So what's next in terms of collaboration for you two? Is something going to happen here that then goes to Cincinnati?
Well, we're going out to dinner next week.
Oh,
we're going to
okay.
have that conversation while I'm still in town.
We are, yeah. You know, it's tricky because some theaters, they kind of release their season maybe in March, April. We just had a slew of theaters announce their season in their 15, 16 seasons in the last couple of weeks, really, a lot of them. Whereas Blake and I, we've been out there for about over a month mm-hmm. now and know what we were doing. So fortunately, not only do we have the commonalities that I talked about, but we also on a similar schedule. And I think one of the key things is to find, I think, again, what I think, I don't want to speak for Blake, but I think I've deduced from our conversations is that I think we both want to feel passionate about the work. You know, you go, what about that? What about that? And you kick out a lot of titles. Well, that's not for us right now, you know. And then suddenly you kind of find something that you go, huh. Okay, and so then we focus on that. Often something, you know, that we want to do, and Blake spoke about this at our meet and greet, was that you try to pick things, not necessarily to save money, but would allow perhaps you to do way more than you could on your own, so that actually everybody wins. The two theaters that are involved win, and that's about being artistically led as much as it is fiscally so.
Well, the important thing, it sounds like, though, is finding something you're both passionate about, and you think will work for both theaters and both audiences.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then everyone had been sort of thinking about Peter and the Starcatcher, and it was a big hit on Broadway, and we'd both seen it and liked it and wanted to like it more. I mean, I wanted to like it more than I did in New York. You know, I was just, I don't know, it just felt a little knowing and a little cynical, occasionally a little blue, you know, crossed over what I consider, you know, I am no prude, but I, you know, crossing over boundaries when there's kids there, and would grandma feel okay with the kids there and not feel weird? I talked to Blake about my reservations, and, you know, and he actually said, well, I really love to play, but I kind of agree with you. I had some of those reservations too. So, you know, what I want to do with it is this. And he explained his vision for the play and what he wanted to extrapolate from the story, where he wanted to emphasize certain things, bring out a lot of heart in it. And I, you know, or more warmth than knowing cynicism in the story, nodding and winking at the story, but really. And I think, you know, he's really done that. So when I saw it, I mean, I texted him straight away and just said, bingo, you know, you did what you said you were going to do. And I actually enjoyed this production way more.
Well, very much looking forward to it. Very glad that this collaboration happened. And I'm looking forward to hearing about the next adventures that you guys are going to have with the two theaters. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Blake Robison is the artistic director of the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, and he's the director of Peter and the Starcatcher, which opens tonight at the Milwaukee Rep. Mark Clements is the Rep's artistic director, and there's more information about the production at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then an in-studio concert and conversation with the band Bua. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Brian Miller, guitarist for the band Bua, was in the studio not too long ago to support his wife, Minnesota singer Nora Rendell. But in Bua, he's one of four equal partners in playing traditional Irish music.
Miller, along with Sean Gavin, Devin Shepard, and UWM grad Brian O'Hart, are on a rare Midwest tour. They'll play this evening at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center, but first they join us in the studio with a set of jigs. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect, the gentlemen of Bua.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So what did we just hear?
We just heard two jigs, and the second one is called The Mountainy Boy, and it's a tune we got from a great collection of tunes made in Chicago in the early 1900s, which is called O'Neill's Music of Ireland. And so the tune is called Mountainy Boy. It's a jig from that book.
Well, before we go any further, I want to have you guys introduce yourselves and what you play, starting on my left.
Okay, great. I'm Sean Gavin. I grew up in Detroit. I play the Illan pipes and the flute.
I'm Devin Shepard, and I'm from Chicago, and I play the fiddle.
Brian O'Hart from St. Louis, and I sing mostly, but I also do a bit of Shannos dancing and play concertina.
Okay.
And I'm Brian Miller. I'm from Minnesota. I play guitar and bouzouki.
Thanks for being here. I have been wanting to get you guys into the studio for probably about 3 or 4 years now.
Jeez, so thanks.
It's just so great that it's finally happening. And you'll be playing tonight. Is that correct?
Correct.
The ICHC, their parlor series, which is kind of in the lower level of the building.
That's the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center. It's always a good time. We've been there in the past a couple of times, and I've played for a few of the Cayleys that they do there. So I'm looking forward to it. It's always a great time.
So how did you guys all meet? How did this band come together?
Well, I suppose, you know, we all grew up in the upper Midwest, and we met each other through Irish music events, I guess, over the years, the Milwaukee Irish Fest being one of them. We were actually asked to be in the band originally by Chris Bain and Jackie Moran, who were original members of Bua, and they asked us to join up.
And then they hightailed it.
And then they left. They said, oh, thank gosh, somebody can take care of this.
Yeah, I suppose maybe.
They had families of their own that were quite taxing. And over the years, I think they've cut down even on the other projects that they were working on as well. So
did you guys all join at the same time, or was it piecemeal over time? How did that work?
We three, meaning me and Brian and Brian, joined at the same time.
2006, I think.
Yeah, and then when the other guys decided that they needed to rein it in, and end their touring days, we asked Devin to join the band. Myself and Devin had been playing together for a long time before that. We've been friends since we were kids, and just seemed like a natural fit. So worked out pretty well, I'd like to think.
Well, and Brian, you have a connection here, too, because you went to UWM.
I did, yeah. I did my undergrad in linguistics and anthropology and did the Celtic Studies program there under the direction of John Gleason at the time. I know Barbara Nihiri is now the head of that. So, yeah, it's nice to be back and see familiar faces and familiar sights here in town.
One of the things that's so interesting to me about how Irish music in particular, but Celtic music in general, has evolved is that the songs are coming back. It's not just the instrumentals. Mm. And the instrumentals are fabulous. I am an instrumentalist, so I have nothing against that. But it's interesting to me that the songs are taking so much more center stage. I mean, Brian, your wife Nora, is a perfect example of that. Brian, you are primarily a singer. What is it about that, do you think? Why is that happening?
Oh, I think in regards to Nora and Brian and the work that they've done collecting and like reviving songs from, you know, from more of the regions where they come from and the things that interest them, I think that's a big driving force. For me, when I learn songs from people and from regions in Ireland that really interest me or that I have a connection to, be it in a minor way or a major way. So for me, and I imagine this is probably the same for Nora and Brian as well, it's the history and the people that collected and recorded and sang those songs and composed them that really intrigue me. And I think it brings a more personalized touch to something that is otherwise very difficult to kind of connect to just, you know, given the songs and the lyrics and stuff like that.
Here's a song.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's more backstory to it, you know, and that plays a big role. It humanizes, you know, the faces of the people that sang the songs that came before you.
Now, I know, Brian, you're very interested in the Northwoods songs mm-hmm. here in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Brian, what are you drawn to when you talk about specific places in Ireland or the United States?
Well, I'm really drawn to Irish Gaelic songs. That's always kind of been the thing that has pulled me into the tradition. You know, when I first started learning singing, it was because I came across, through public radio, through NPR, and listening to probably Clonid, you know, or something like Scarabray, you know, coming across the Irish language and having that really capture my imagination in my early teens that brought me into listening to songs in the Irish language and then finally finding the older Shannos tradition. And then having spent time over there learning and doing programs through UWM when I was an undergrad, it just really struck me. And there were so many native speakers living in Chicago at the time that were here for the festivals, for the Milwaukee Irish Fest, that really shared a lot with me, even if it wasn't necessarily songs and repertoire, but it was just friendship and support. And that's kind of followed me all the way through into living in Ireland as well and coming into a community where people are normally standoffish because it's very tight-knit, and then being able to speak to them in their own language. Doors really open up, you know, and conversations open up. And
the stories are shared.
And the stories are shared in the way that they're not necessarily shared for some people who don't have access to the language. So having that, it was a foothold to get me deeper into song traditions. And, of course, there are songs in English I like as well. I do a lot of work with Len Graham, who's a singer from County Antrim. We just released a new album there last week. And so I've been learning a lot of his repertoire of songs from Ulster, the ballad tradition in English.
So Devin and Sean, were you aware of the more the vocal tradition, the song traditions, or was for you guys it started really with the instrumental?
For me, I suppose I was certainly aware of both. My father is a fiddle player, Mick Gavin from Clare, and my older brother is also a musician. So I probably was more into the tunes when I was a kid, learning and stuff like that. But my brother and my dad were all big fans of Planxty and, you know, Christy Moore and that type of stuff. So I grew up listening to a lot of that type of stuff. And my brother's also a singer. So, you know, similarly as to what Brian was saying there, I probably first was more familiar with the songs through bands and, you know, individual performers, I suppose. But I think as we've all gotten more into the music, you know, we've all looked in different places for information, I suppose, on how to think about some of these things a little differently. And I've been really lucky lately to spend some time with the guy Seamus Begley, who's a great singer. Spending time with him has definitely made me think a little differently about the song tradition. But I grew up playing the tunes, so that would have been playing for dancers and stuff and playing in the house. And my dad used to take me over to Ireland and down to Chicago to take lessons. That's where I met Devin when we were kids. He used to play at the Flaws and Milwaukee Irish Fest and stuff like that.
I just love the idea of how the two things, of course, they grew up together, you know, people were always singing or playing, but that how they feed each other now, you know, how you approach a tune differently because of songs and being aware of songs, and how you approach a song differently because of how the tunes are.
It's really funny you mentioned that, because yesterday we actually just gave a workshop on this exact thing, the connection between songs and the dance tunes. So it's funny you bring that up.
I'm psychic.
It's also been, you know, it's a challenge when we join the band to arrange songs in a way that I feel kind of holds the integrity of the song, but at the same time yielding to the fact that we have to put it in a timing, you know, a time signature, and that it has to accommodate other instruments and accommodate a wider audience than just singing an unaccompanied song. You know,
so. I was going to say, because most of them were a cappella, right? They were just sung, the bard was singing the song.
And in general, that would be mostly true, just unaccompanied song or singing in unison, which is what I do with Len on the newer album. But unaccompanied, and that's not everyone's cup of tea, to be honest, especially coming from other traditions. If they're not very familiar with the Irish tradition, it can be a little difficult sometimes. So arranging it certainly makes it more palatable for a wider audience. It's very fun to work with these guys to arrange the songs in a way that we all feel very comfortable with.
Well, tell me about the one we're going to hear, because this is one that you would have had to arrange, right?
Yeah, well, this is a song that comes from the labors of Brian here and his collections and work with the songs of the lumber camps. It's called James Wayland, and James Wayland was a young Irishman who was working in the lumber camps in Ontario, I believe, and unfortunately lost his life breaking a logjam. And so this is kind of the retelling of the story using an older ballad form, which happened a lot in the lumber camps. The airs were being used and new lyrics were being written to tell the stories of the Irish in North America.
Yeah. Anything else before we go into
it? No, well put, Brian. Nice work.
All right.
Learn from the best.
Yeah, this one was – it was actually collected in my hometown. I will say that. And so, you know, one thing about getting interested in the songs, there's so many great resources out there for both the tunes that we play, like O'Neill's book, and just collecting throughout the entire 20th century has really influenced the repertoire we choose. So this one was collected in my hometown in 1922 from an old singer named Albert Hanna.
Gentlemen and maidens, I pray you to draw near. An accident most terrible, I mean to let you hear. It's of a young and noble youth, James Wayland he was called. He was drowned off Pete McLaurin's raft behind.
Brian Miller, Sean Gavin, Devin Shepherd, and Brian O'Hart make up the mostly Midwestern-based band BUA. They'll play this evening at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center in Milwaukee, and there is a link to more from WUWM.com. That's Friday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie and I help produce the show every week, along with Dan Harmon and Audrey Nowakowski, plus our intern, Claire Mosley. And we get web support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from John Strelecki.
Many thanks for listening this morning, and do be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Right now it's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned, because Fresh Air is next.
Then up spoke noble Wayland unto his comrades all, saying, come all ye, though 'tis dangerous, we'll do as we are told. We'll obey our orders manfully, as noble men should do. But as he spoke, the jam it broke, and let